From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We are venturing onto the high frontier of the super wealthy investor tonight, past the barricades that keep everyone else out, into the $1 trillion world of hedge funds, where big bets are made, where the returns are supersized, where the rich get even richer, and where some worry the crowd may now be too much. This hour, On Point, big returns and new worries in the super secret world of hedge funds. But first, we begin tonight in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, where the Organization of American States is holding its General Assembly. The United States last hosted the annual meeting of the OAS 31 years ago. Today, President Bush addressed delegates from the 34 attending countries, representing every North and South American nation but Cuba.
Today, all 34 countries participating in this General Assembly have democratic constitutional governments. Only one country in this hemisphere sits outside this society of democratic nations. And one day, the tide of freedom will reach Cuba's shores as well.
The president touted democracy and hemisphere-wide free trade today, but it was not all smiles and sunshine at the Florida meeting. Pablo Bachelet is Latin America correspondent for the Miami Herald and joins me now. Pablo, thanks for being with us tonight.
Nice to talk to you, Tom.
What was the atmosphere at the OAS meeting today?
I would say it was relaxed. There's a lot of backroom maneuvering going on. They're trying to work something out where they can put out a declaration or resolution that basically supports democracy more in Latin America. There are some troubled democracies in this region. You've had problems in Bolivia. You've had a government fall very recently in Ecuador. And there have been four governments that have been ousted early in the last 4 years. So really they're trying to tackle that problem here and find ways to make this democracies more effective. And Bush alluded to that in his speech.
Were his comments on democracy well received? Is the Washington lined up with the Latin American perspective, let's say, on supporting democracy right now?
They were, because they weren't very specific. I was just talking to Ali Rodriguez, the foreign minister of Venezuela, and he said he was in agreement with what Bush had to say, except the part where he spoke about Cuba. But in general, he was in agreement. So Bush's remarks in that respect were well received. Where there are problems are on some specific U.S. proposals to strengthen democracy.
Such as?
There's talk of getting more civic groups to participate more directly, non-governmental organizations to participate more directly in the way the OAS functions. And several governments really oppose that. The Venezuelans are very much opposed to it. The argument is this is an organization of states, not of non-governmental organizations. And that's something that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has really been pushing. And it looks like that might not happen.
Free trade is almost always on the agenda at these meetings. What's the state of the free trade conversation this year, and in particular the CAFTA agreement around Central America?
Well, Bush made a call for Congress to pass CAFTA. Really, the ball is in Congress's court. Three Central American countries have already ratified CAFTA in their Congresses. Everybody's expecting the U.S. Congress to do something. Bush has made it one of his top priorities to get Congress to pass it. There is a lot of... there are problems with passing it in Congress. The sugar lobby is dead set against it. The labor groups are dead set against it. And this time it seems they have the votes to stop it so far. So Bush, by coming here to Fort Lauderdale, he tried to give a push to CAFTA using this the stage here of having these 34 countries meeting here in Florida.
Well, Pablo, there's been a lot of talk about China's increasing interest in the natural resources of South America in particular, Central America as well, and in trade relations there. Is there a sense that the United States is still the big fish in this pond, the pole that everyone looks to, or not?
I think so. I mean... yes, China's influence is growing. There are increasing links between China and some very specific countries in Latin America. Venezuela is one that comes to mind. Venezuela is trying to sell more oil to China. That raises some concerns. But generally speaking, everybody understands that the U.S. is the big fish in the pond. It's the market that really takes in most of the exports that come from Latin America still to this day. And a lot of countries do want to trade more with the United States. They want more free trade with the United States. But there are divisions, and not all of Latin America views the U.S. the same way. So you've got Argentina and Brazil, perhaps, looking to trade more with the United States, but they want to export more agricultural products, which is something difficult to do to the United States because of the subsidies mm-hmm. here. So there are issues that separate the waters.
Well, I just wanted to ask about the tensions between Washington and Venezuela and Cuba. Were they evident today, or are they evident in the conversation there in Fort Lauderdale?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Cuba was suspended in 1962, and Condoleezza Rice, in her remarks, made reference to the empty chair. Brazil said, we want to solve this issue of the empty chair. We've made proposals in the past. When Bush mentioned this, the issue about Cuba, the Venezuelans made an objection to it, but I don't think they made it in public. It was when they talked to us in the press. So Cuba, everybody understands that the OAS, it's something you talk about. There's a lot of politics involved. This is, after all, South Florida. But at the end of the day, it's really not going to change. The administration is not going to change its policies. Latin America isn't going to change its stance on the issue.
And on goes the great conclave. Pablo Bachelet, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
It was a pleasure, Tom.
Pablo Bachelet, Latin American correspondent for the Miami Herald. He spoke with us from Fort Lauderdale. The top 25 hedge fund managers in America made an average of $250 million apiece last year. The top earner, Edward S. Lampert at ESL Investment, earned $1 billion. Hedge funds are the white-hot high frontier of American investing today, but they're not like mutual funds. They are loosely regulated, private partnerships. They're supposed to do well in both rising and falling markets. Very well. An annual return of 25 or 30% can be par for the course here. Just getting in requires big money. But now some are worried the hedge fund field is too crowded, with potential to hurt even small investors. Hedge funds now control $1 trillion in assets. Yet you've probably never heard of some of the biggest hedge fund players like AQE, Eaton Park, and Renaissance. That's because they don't like to talk about their strategies, about their investors, about the size of their bonus checks. But tonight we've got two escorts from the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal to take us past the red ropes this hour on Point inside the super big money world of hedge funds. You can join the conversation with the markets limping along in a real estate bubbly. Have you been dreaming of hedge fund-sized returns? Can you imagine how much money an industry has to make for its top player to take home a $1 billion pay package? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Amherst, Massachusetts, is Joe Nocera, business columnist for the New York Times and staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. His article on hedge funds, The Quantitative Data-Based Risk-Massaging Road to Riches, appeared in this week's New York Times Magazine. He's former editorial director at Fortune Magazine. Joe Nocera, wonderful to have you with us tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. This is, I hope, going to be fun.
Well, I'm sure it will. It's quite a story that you tell in your piece this weekend, Joe, and I wish you'd just begin by taking us a little bit into the world of the gentleman you profiled there, a significant hedge fund trader, Clifford Asness. Am I pronouncing that right?
Well, yes, you are. And he's a 38-year-old guy who's run this fund since he was 31. It's done very well. It's a very complicated strategy that he uses, in which he has a basket of stocks long, which means he's bought a basket of stocks, and he's also short an equivalent size basket of stocks. And, he's trying to make money by having the computer model, he hopes, will have his longs do a little bit better than his shorts, or his shorts do a little better than his longs, depending on what the market's doing. It is complicated. You and I can't do it. But you get a little bit off point in talking about Cliff in particular, I think, because hedge funds are not one thing. They they have more to do with structure and the regulatory environment in which they operate, or lack of regulatory environment in which they operate, than they do with a particular kind of investing strategy. There are all kinds of investing strategies having to do with hedge funds.
Everything from the kind of data massaging, as you say, that Cliff does, to investing in metals and commodities and many ways of going at the stock market, even investing in whole economies, even artwork we hear lately.
Well, well, what they're really doing, you know, these guys are rich and they're buying art. You know, so that's kind of what happens when anybody in America gets rich. They start to decide they like wine and art and all sorts of expensive things that they used to not be able to buy.
Rich, no kidding, $1 trillion in hedge funds today, twice as much as just a few years ago. Why has this money gushed into hedge funds, Joe?
Well, there are two reasons. One is that hedge funds have done quite well, particularly in the bear market after the internet bubble. You remember the internet bubble, don't you, Tom?
Just a little, yeah.
After the internet bubble crashed, you know, the market went down, and a lot of people, a lot of institutions that had, you know, been counting on a rising stock market were suddenly losing money. And hedge funds actually performed quite well during the downturn. They, in effect, broke even. Some of them, quite a few of them, made money. And so the institutions that, you know, the university endowments and the hospital endowments and the pension funds and so on, started to look around and, you know, who's making money out there? And it was hedge funds. And so there was kind of a mad dash into hedge funds because it was the flavor du jour on Wall Street.
They were making money even when the market was down, and making it by design. We'll come back and look at how hedge funds position themselves to do that, who invests, who can, who can't, and where they're going now. We're talking tonight with Joe Nocera with the New York Times. You can join the conversation as well. Do you drool at those 25, 35, 45% returns? How would that look on your 401k statement? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the super secret world of hedge funds, looking at how the rich get richer and whether the party there can last. We're joined tonight by Joe Nocera. He's business columnist for the New York Times and staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. First piece in the magazine in that capacity just this last weekend, and it was a doozy about the world of hedge funds, profiling one trader in particular. It's an amazing world. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you drool at those giant returns? And what about the hedge fund slowdown this year? Is the party over? Are you a hedge fund trader? How's biz? Are you invested in a hedge fund? How's it doing for you? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joe Nocera is with us. We're joined as well right now from New York by Gregory Zuckerman. He covers hedge funds for the Wall Street Journal. Gregory Zuckerman, wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, nice to be here.
Gregory, I wish you'd jump in with a little hedge fund 101 for us and just give us what's the difference for somebody who has nothing invested in hedge funds and wants to understand between a mutual fund, let's say, and a hedge fund? The difference on many angles, describe them for us.
Sure. One is sexy and one is not.
Yeah.
But beyond that, mutual funds have some restrictions on them. They can't do sort of the interesting and sometimes aggressive things that a lot of hedge funds can. In other words, if you're a mutual fund manager and you don't believe the market is going higher, there's just so much you can do. You can't really go all cash. In other words, go to the sidelines.
Right.
That's what a hedge fund can do. You can't really bet against the market to the extent that a hedge fund can. And you can't use leverage, borrow money, and if you really like a position, a stock, a bond, a certain trade, a hedge fund can leverage up and really make a big bet and make a lot more. So in a lot of ways, they've got more leeway, a hedge fund does, but also they don't have to report and disclose, and there's much less transparency when it comes to a hedge fund. A mutual fund, every day you look in the newspaper, you go online and you see the net asset value in a hedge fund. It's not the same way. It's harder to get returns, even if you're an investor, especially daily. You can get it, but it's harder. It's also harder to pull out. A mutual fund, you can pull out any day from your mutual fund. There are lockups when it comes to a hedge fund. Sometimes it's monthly, sometimes it's quarterly, sometimes it's every few years even.
Joe Nocera, essentially unregulated here, unlike the mutual fund world, as well as Greg Zuckerman says. Who can get in to a hedge fund and who can't?
Rich people.
How
can
rich?
Get in. and the rest of us can't.
Yeah, well, how rich?
Greg, what is it? Is it 5 million now or a million? Basically,
the so-called qualified investor based on how rich you are. If you're rich enough, the government assumes you can watch out for yourself. How big is that pile these days?
If you make an annual salary of $200,000, or you and your spouse make $300,000, or you've got assets of a million, you can get into a hedge fund. And, you know, nowadays, more people are above that threshold, but most mutual funds, or, I'm sorry, hedge funds, or at least the larger hedge funds, actually have a higher bar, about $5 million.
$5 million in net worth?
Yes.
Before they'll let you in. So, I mean, $200,000, a lot of people make that these days, but the real bar is higher. Joe, you describe it as rich.
Well, the real fact is that although certainly there are a lot of wealthy people in hedge funds, the real customers for hedge funds right now and what's driving this hedge fund bubble are institutions, are large institutions like pension funds and university endowments. Those are the bread and butter customers, and those are the people who those are the institutions that hedge funds are trying to cater to. So it's not exactly a misnomer to say that it's all about rich people, but it, you know, rich people used to be 100% or 95% of the customer base, and now it's a lot smaller, and it's not even the customer that the hedge fund that most hedge fund managers prefer.
Joe, describe for us how hedge fund managers take home these enormous pay packages, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, even a billion.
Sure. One difference between a mutual fund and a hedge fund is that a mutual fund makes its money primarily through asset fees. In other words, it takes a piece of the entire pot as its, however, you know, Fidelity Magellan, I can't remember what it is now, $80 billion, $70 billion, actually it's lower than that.
And a percentage every year goes right in their pocket.
And a percentage of that every year goes to Fidelity. Mm-hmm. That's the way it works. Now, a hedge fund also usually has an asset fee, so it also takes a percentage. But it also has a performance fee, and that performance fee can be anywhere from 15 to, I mean, I know there's one hedge fund out there that charges 44%.
That is of whatever profit they make each year.
That's right. They take 20% of the profit, and that's where the big money is made. And if they have a really good year, they put tens of millions of dollars in their pocket. And it also depends on how many partners they have, how much of their own money is the fund. There's a lot of, you know, George Soros did not have a particularly good this year.
Right.
I believe he was only up 5%. But he has so much of his own money in his own fund. In fact, it's primarily his own money that basically, you know, whatever profit it makes goes to him. So that's why they make so much money. And the other thing is because we're in this bubble, institutions and wealthy people alike are not complaining about the fees. They're just kind of so busy trying to tumble their way into hedge funds that they all seem perfectly happy to pay it.
We'll look at that bubble in a second. But Gregory Zuckerman, I wish you'd spell out a little more for us how hedge funds bring in these terrific returns even when the market's not doing that well. What are some of the strategies, the tricks of the trade? I mean, just very basically, how do they do it? The very name, hedge fund, comes from hedging against loss, but they do more than that. They keep the big returns coming even when the market's not doing well. How?
They often do. They haven't necessarily been doing it lately.
The last few months, right.
But, they can do all kinds of interesting strategies. Most people think about the aggressive ones, let's say betting against the pound, which is what George Soros did.
So currency trading, yeah.
Yeah, and aggressively done, and it starts there with the aggressive stuff, but it becomes really kind of boring as well, betting that a merger will take place, betting that one security will outperform another. Let's say you think Walmart is cheap and Sears is expensive, so you'll buy Walmart and you'll bet against Sears.
Yeah.
And you're basically betting that one will outperform the other. Quite frankly, that's somewhat of a boring strategy and not necessarily what hedge funds are known for, but that's a lot of what they do, especially as Joe said, as they start catering to the institutions, they become actually a little less aggressive because they just don't want to rock the boat. They're doing so well, they don't want to blow it. So they figure, hey, if I do pretty well, then I'm going to keep all these assets. The beautiful thing about the hedge fund model, both for the investor and for the hedge funds themselves for sure, is it's all about performance, as opposed to a mutual fund where, oh, my mutual fund's down 10%, but the market's down 11%. They're high-fiving. They think it's a great year. And, you know, truth be told, that's pretty pathetic. A hedge fund not only will be discouraged by being down 10%, even if the market's down 11%, but they may have to close up, because it's all about that incentive fee that you talked about, 20% plus. And
on the profit they make it. If they don't make it, exactly, they're out of business.
Exactly. Well, they're not out of business, but their investors get frustrated. Their employees know they won't have a big paycheck at the end of the year, so they'll go next door to the next hedge fund.
Right.
So it's all about performance when it comes to a hedge fund.
Joe, you call it the most Darwinian of investment vehicles, right, because so much depends on that take every year.
Right. I was interviewing a successful hedge fund manager who must remain nameless, alas. Mm. And, you know, he told me, we were having this conversation, and, you know, he's got like a couple of $1 billion under management, and he's been doing it for a while, and he's good at it.
Yeah.
And he said, last summer I was down 5%. 5%. Mm. And, you know, I locked my door. I stopped talking to my hedge fund buddies. I put the curtain down, and I hunkered down for 6 months because my business was at risk. Mm. And I defy you to find a mutual fund manager who's down 5% and says my business is at risk. It's not. Go ahead, Greg. I'm sorry.
As you've noted yourself, as you've written, many mutual funds should be at risk if they're down double digits. Those were in things like Fidelity Growth Fund, those kind of things, you know, down 20-30% from the top or more. They sure wish that their managers felt bad about their returns, but often they don't.
But they roll on, and hedge funds don't necessarily. Joe, let me ask you, I mean, I realize they got some very sophisticated software programming and strategies going on here, but why the deep, deep secrecy? Is the rocket science that special? It sounds like
this. No. It has nothing to do with the rocket science at all.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with several things. First of all, the SEC has, in my opinion, bizarre rules limiting what constitutes marketing for a hedge fund. I know of several recent examples where two hedge funds were forced to close their websites because the SEC ruled that was quote unquote marketing and that the common person could look at it. One of the reasons hedge funds managers don't talk to the press is because they're so terrified that the SEC will rule that an example of marketing and slap their wrist. And their lawyers are constantly telling them you can't talk to the press because that's marketing.
And why is the SEC so worried about that, Joe? Because you can't get in anyway unless they invite you in.
Right.
I mean,
I'm actually not that clear about that. Mm-hmm.
Well,
and then the second...
What do you say,
Go
Greg?
Ahead, Greg.
Well, if I can just jump in.
Yeah.
It's a de facto deal, basically, they made. We'll let you guys do your thing. Invest the way you want to invest, as long as you are a little different than the mutual fund. You don't solicit funds publicly, and that's talk to different lawyers, but some argue, well, if I'm out there talking to the press, if I'm out there with a website, then I'm soliciting funds from the average investor, and we don't want that.
So you keep it a kind of a Daddy Warbucks game. We've got that. And Joe, another reason for secrecy?
But wait, the second reason for secrecy is the clients would just assume there's no percentage in not being secretive. The clients get annoyed. It just doesn't usually have a good end for a hedge fund manager to start talking to the press. Mm. Now let me just say one thing about this because I think it's important.
Mm.
This was all fine and well when hedge funds were a little cottage industry, and you know. Michael Steinhardt at his top, you know, didn't have the kind of money under management that a lot of these guys do. It wasn't a $1 trillion industry then. It didn't have this power to move markets.
You're talking the 80s, the early 90s.
Yeah, you didn't have people basically trying to take over companies or agitating for change. And this culture of secrecy, I think, is one of the things that's really hurt hedge funds as they become more prominent, because it scares people. It scares regulators. you know, you have something like the blow up of long-term capital management in the late 90s, mm-hmm. and people say, oh my God, how many other hedge funds are leveraged like that? Could that happen again? And I think part of the undercurrent right now in people worrying about hedge funds is, oh my God, is there going to be another long-term capital management which will threaten the foundations of the financial system? And people, you know, it's so secretive that there's no reason people shouldn't worry about that because they don't really know what's going on. And so I think the SEC and the hedge fund industry are both doing the country a disservice by reinforcing this culture of secrecy.
I want to hear from a voice right out of that industry. Joe Gregory-Zuckerman, please stand by. I want to welcome in Charles Guardante. He's managing principal, Hennessy Hedge Fund Advisory Group. They advise investors about hedge funds. Charles Guardante, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
So here we're seeing this explosion in the number of hedge funds, 8,000 roughly out there now, $1 trillion being invested and managed. Joe Nocera is just saying that's creating some fears with the secrecy that's traditionally been around hedge funds about where this is taking all that money, where it might take the markets. What's your sense of the health of the hedge fund world, Charles?
First, let's understand the background of hedge funds. The way they trade, going long and short stocks or long and short bonds, is nothing new. This goes back to the 20s,
right.
The 1920s.
Mm-hmm. Just an awful lot more of it.
Investment banks were doing it in the 20s. People believe that A.W. Jones was the first hedge fund. He was the first hedge fund limited partnership. But the strategy of going long and short stocks and bonds is over 80 years old. Now, as far as the secrecy of it, well, there is some secrecy, and I think Gregory made some good points about the reasons why. But we also have to recall that Goldman Sachs is secret about their proprietary trading, investment, so is Lehman Brothers. And furthermore, this feeling that we've had a sea change due to the advent of hedge funds, let's recall that in the 70s, oil went from $10 a barrel to $60 a barrel. And we had gasoline lines that were 3 hours long.
Yeah.
Gold went from $30 an ounce to $900 an ounce. We had a bear market in the 70s that declined 50%. In the 80s, the dollar declined against the yen 50%, and we had the stock market crash of 87.
And what should we learn from that?
Hedge funds were not a player in the market. So now all of a sudden we have a bear market. From 2000 to 2002,
right.
We had the dollar declining against the euro. We have oil going up,
mm-hmm.
and gold went up, and hedge funds are the explanation for all those things.
And you're saying lay off?
I would not agree with that.
This is my point. There are hedgers,
yeah.
and there are hedge funds, and hedge funds are a subset of a group of industries that have to hedge. Japan has to hedge their oil. We read about Southwest Airlines that hedged their oil and put pressure on oil prices because
mm-hmm.
they were buying futures contracts
right.
when oil was at $35 a barrel. That puts upward pressures on oil. Furthermore, the New York Mercantile Exchange said that hedge funds, with respect to oil and gas, do not put pressure on prices. They have not added this $10 premium.
They said there's pressure put on there.
Mercantile said that hedge funds provide liquidity and reduce volatility.
Joe Nocera, what do you say? Here's a voice from the industry saying, look, you got a bear market. It's not our fault. Please.
I don't think anybody's saying it is their fault.
Okay.
Who's saying it's their fault? I think this is an argument.
We're sort of painting a clandestine picture about hedge funds, and yet Merrill Lynch doesn't tell us what the proprietary book is.
Well, let me throw this in if I may. Gregory Zuckerman, let me ask you about this then. William Donaldson at the SEC, of course, he's out now, former chairman there, not long ago, warning of a disaster, his word, facing investors in the hedge fund industry because the crowding into investment strategies. Alan Greenspan warning about problems there. I'm looking here at the Center for Economics and Business Research in London saying hedge fund investing is now like horse racing, betting on horse races. Why this stream of criticism, Greg?
Well, I think you have to make a distinction. There's a worry about the so-called hedge fund bubble to the extent that returns are going to come down. I think that's true, but there's some people that worry that it's going to lead to some catastrophe, and I think that's a little overblown. And, you know, Chairman Greenspan himself has said that hedge funds play a really useful
mm-hmm.
role in providing liquidity. Everyone, I think, remembers 1998 when long-term capital blew up in
But Gregory, that was a banking problem.
All that lending to one hedge fund that just about came back to bite. We just got Charles Guardante, if I may, we just got a minute before the break here. I want to ask you, is there a limit to how much investment capital ought to be in hedge funds? We're at $1 trillion now. Is the sky the limit? What do you think?
Now, it's a zero-sum game on the long side of a hedge fund portfolio. Money's coming out of the long-only managers into hedge funds, and so one manager is selling Dell to take a redemption, and the money's going into a hedge fund, and he's buying Dell. The difference is that he's also shorting Hewlett-Packard. The glass ceiling in the hedge fund industry is a function of the shorting that is limited, not a function of the longs. That they can put on the books.
Well, it's a world of its own. Charles Guardante, thank you very much for being with us tonight. Joe Nocera, Gregory Zuckerman, please stand by. Listeners, you can join us. Are you invested in a hedge fund? How's it doing for you? And why do you think Greenspan and the former SEC chairman have spoken out nervously about hedge funds? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the super big money world of hedge funds. Who's in it? Who's not? And where it's headed? We're joined tonight by Gregory Zuckerman of the Wall Street Journal, joining us from New York. And from Amherst, Massachusetts, Joe Nocera, business columnist, as of late for the New York Times, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. You may have seen his piece in Sunday's magazine, The Quantitative Database, Risk Massaging Road to Riches. You can join the conversation as well, 1-800-423-8255. Let's turn to our long-suffering, waiting callers. Julie's calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Julie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a question about which funds I might particularly be eligible to invest in. I am a 32-year-old physician, so I have a decent earning capacity for a while. I have some risk tolerance based on that.
Have you got the million-dollar, multi-million-dollar profile, Julie?
So I have $1 million to invest,
right?
Which is now in stocks and mutual funds, which I've managed on my own, and I have a lot of interest in, you know, the investing industry, but it's, you know, time consuming and fairly stressful, and you know, I definitely am not gathering the 20, 30, 35%.
But those returns sound pretty good. Julie, stand by, because the doctors are in the house tonight. Joe, what do you say to our doctor from Durham?
Well, I'm going to break your heart a little. First of all, I feel deeply uncomfortable recommending any hedge fund to any individual investor, so I'm not going to do it. Second of all, on the larger point, this is the point we've alluded to a bunch, but we haven't really talked about explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get into the good hedge funds. I mean, you just can't. They're mostly closed. One difference between hedge funds and mutual funds is they don't balloon to $70 billion. They stay a lot smaller, and the reason they stay a lot smaller is precisely because performance matters so much to them, and the larger any kind of fund gets, the harder it is to make money. So, you know, a hedge fund will top out at $13 billion instead of 20 or 30 or 40 or 50. So what's happening now is that there's a rush to start hedge funds by people who've never done it before. And there's a rush to put money in those hedge funds mm-hmm. by people who haven't invested in them in before. And so basically you've got the blind leading the blind. And, we have talked about the hedge fund bubble and, you know, where we're headed. And I think where we're headed is towards mediocrity, because in any kind of investing strategy, it always starts great, and as it gets imitated and imitated mm-hmm. and imitated and imitated, as Jim Chanos said in my article, imitation leads to mediocrity. And, you know, I would basically say for somebody like you, you probably should stay away and wait and see how this thing shakes out, and also see if hedge funds are going to last in a way that makes it possible for somebody with $1 million net worth to feel comfortable being in them.
There's one angle on it. Gregory Zuckerman, what do you say? You can hear the desire for those big returns. Julie's not alone. Lots of people tumbling in, as Joe Nocera says. Is it too late in the party?
Well, I think hedge funds play a role in the portfolios of some individual investors. You've got to have enough money that you can tie it up here. You've got to be able to do some due diligence, and I can't imagine the average investor actually can on a hedge fund. So a lot of brokerage firms have rolled out these products called funds of funds. So sort of like mutual funds, they're mm-hmm. funds of other hedge funds, and basically they will do the due diligence for you and kind of spread your hedge fund investments around. And the reason I do think there's a role for an investor is because they do have a lot more going for them than a mutual fund or a kind of more traditional asset manager, as we've talked about. Mm. The problem with these fund of funds products is they're very expensive, and if you think that hedge funds are expensive, and they are sort of 2% or more of assets plus 20% plus of all the gains, they layer fees on top of that. It becomes really very expensive and reduces returns that much more so. The best hedge funds are still going to outperform mutual funds and other investments, if only because they make so much money, they're really draining a lot of the brain power away from the mutual funds and other places, the traditional investments. But for the average investor, it's a little bit of a dicey proposition to find an individual hedge fund or, again, a fund-to-fund product. There are some that are a little cheaper and some are more attractive.
Well, Julie, there's a sense of the way in and a pretty strong buyer beware. Joan Nocera, reading your piece on Sunday, I found myself thinking it's almost as though this is where the action has migrated. I mean, so many Americans have come into the stock market in the last 20 years that it seems just humdrum today. Now, it's sort of, if you're not in hedge funds, you're not really a player.
Oh, I suppose. But this too shall pass is the way I feel about it. Didn't everybody want to be in junk bonds in the 1980s? And didn't everybody want to be in dot-coms in the 1990s? Mm-hmm. There is something Greg had a good phrase for it. You know, there is something about the way hedge funds are run that I do believe is inherently superior to the way a mutual fund is run, just because they have more flexibility and because I think there is something valuable in being able to go short as well as to buy stocks. And I think a lot of these strategies, you know, make a certain sense. And it's kind of too bad that this is really never going to be available to you and me. It's just not. But I would also say that I do think that as more people get into it, as I've said before, the returns are going to decrease, and it's going to become much less glamorous and sexy than it is right now.
Gregory Zuckerman, is there a downside for the little guy with all these hedge funds zooming around? You write that hedge fund worries have the market on edge. Do they make the whole market more volatile for ordinary investors?
Well, the average hedge fund is a little more short-term oriented than the average mutual fund or a traditional investment. So to the extent that it adds volatility, I guess it does put people on edge, although the market hasn't been very volatile in the last couple of years. There is an irony here I just thought I'd throw out, that the reason why hedge funds are so popular lately is because so many investors, especially institutional, kind of larger endowments and pension plans, are still scarred from the bear market. And rather than looking for the next hot investment, they're actually looking for some investment that's going to protect their downside during the next bear market. And more than ever, hedge funds are actually much more conservative in their strategies to attract these institutional investors, and also not to kind of blow a good thing they've got going.
So, but wouldn't everybody like to protect their downside after what happened a few years ago? Let's take another call. Steve's calling from Exeter, New Hampshire. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to amend something that Joe Nocera said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
When he said that hedge funds really weren't for you and me, they were complicated models and largely secret. And more recently, he just said that hedge funds were draining a lot of the brains away from mutual funds, and he implied that that was partly explained their greater returns. I think that really needs correction.
A lot of people jumping over there. A lot of good minds.
And there are a lot of people doing there. There's a good sales job done indirectly in the paper and by the
mystique of the hedge fund. Okay, but what do you say, Steve?
What's that?
So what's your take on it?
Well, there's a long-running debates about whether these models, various models, really can do any better than the monkey throwing darts at the Wall Street Journal stock.
Isn't
pages.
The proof in the pudding? I mean, look at those big returns.
I beg your pardon?
Isn't the proof in the pudding? When you look at the big returns, they've done a lot better.
No, it's not, because some of these returns are temporary. The good hedge fund managers, like good mutual fund managers from this year or past years, are not the ones in the future. And, you know, these models really are the sort of thing that a lot of, like a person, a good undergraduate could program. What they don't have is the confidence of a lot of investors who are willing to put money in on the chance that these hedge funds will make big money for a given year.
Steve, we've got the view, and we thank you for your call. Let's get one more call here. Steve's call. Calling from Brockton, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I guess I'm really trying to find the story here, and it's because everything I hear is that on a risk-adjusted basis,
yeah.
apples to apples, taking account of the relative risk of a hedge fund investment versus some other investment, that these, on a risk-adjusted basis, are probably don't generate net returns any better than mutual funds do. If they do, well, that's an interesting story. And the question is, well, how? Is there something about the secrecy that has given them access to information that other investors don't have? I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Let us jump straight into it, Steve. Our time's short. Gregory Zuckerman, speak to that. The question remains out there. Is it really greater, risk-adjusted, than your mutual fund, and how?
Yes, I do believe they historically have outperformed. The databases that the hedge fund business use exaggerate the return. So there is a strong argument that they're not quite as successful as the industry will sell itself on being. That said, they just have more flexibility. They've got they got the brain power because they pay more, so they hire the best people away from Wall Street. It's not to say that aren't really good mutual funds, aren't really good asset managers. But the story is, and they are bigger than ever, and they have more of an impact on the stock market, on parts of the bond market. They dominate. The convertible bond market, they own more than 80%, it's been estimated, of all convertible bonds. So they've become to move the market around in some important sectors of the market.
So, and finally, Joe,
I just want to say I really do believe that on a risk-adjusted basis, mm-hmm. a good hedge fund outperforms a good mutual fund, precisely because it's not completely beholden to the ups and downs of the market, because they're limiting the extent to which their returns are linked to whether the market's going up or down. I think there's something powerful in that.
And we just got a half minute left here, but Joe, looking back at what happened with long-term capital management, the government had to step in and orchestrate to kind of play the savior role there. Is all this fair? Or is the government standing there waiting to bail this out on behalf of those rich few who can get in at the end of the day? Is it equitable?
Well, the government bailed out long-term capital management not because it really cared about long-term capital management, but because it was basically putting the banking system seemed to be at risk.
But a bailout's a bailout.
Their leverage was so off the charts. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons you'd like to have at least, not necessarily, you know, regulation, but I do believe the government ought to know what the hell's going on inside of hedge funds. I do believe that, because what would be wrong is if you have another long-term capital management after the first long-term capital management.
Right.
Then you sort of wonder, you know, why isn't anybody paying attention?
Of course, William Donaldson was for that at the SEC. I think I'm hearing Gregory Zuckerman that Chris Cox is not.
It's not clear yet. Jury's still out. They've already... In February, they're supposed to make this change where the larger hedge fund firms have to register. So it's not clear whether this will happen. And I agree. I don't think it's a bad thing for them to know more about what's going on. Every indication is there's not the same kind of risk and leverage, but you never know around the corner.
We'll be watching on that front. Gregory Zuckerman at the Wall Street Journal, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Joe Nocera at the New York Times, thanks very much for being with us, Joe. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me. Greg, nice to talk to you.
In a moment, Dan Rather speaks on the future of investigative journalism. This is On Point. Following last week's unveiling of Deep Throat, the anonymous source that helped two Washington Post reporters bring down President Nixon, former CBS News reporter Dan Rather is reminding his fellow journalists of the importance of investigative journalism. Rather stepped down as CBS News anchor in March after conceding that a report he did last fall on President Bush's Vietnam War record got the story wrong. But speaking over the weekend at the annual convention of investigative reporters and editors, Rather said that Watergate serves as a reminder of the power of government to manipulate the press. "There's never been a better reason for investigative reporting," Rather said. "I hope the public sees it that way." Here's an excerpt from Dan Rather's address.
"Do we understand that if we don't do our jobs completely and well, that our microphones, our cameras, and our questions cease to be ways to set the record straight and microscopes for examining and evaluating truths? They become instead magnifying glasses that amplify falsehoods. Further, do we still believe that each American citizen is a stakeholder in this nation and that it is to the public that every elected official is ultimately accountable?" You say, "Yes, Tim, I believe that. We were taught it in seventh grade. The question is, do we as a nation, as a people, and we as journalists, do we still believe that? Do we believe that every piece of paper produced by our government is the property of the people of the United States and should be accessible to the people, with the exception of legitimate, underscore the word, national security matters, and very little else? Many of these questions were posed long ago, either directly or in paraphrase, in the work of journalism scholar Lewis W. Wilson. And he also wrote about the following, and I ask if you think we still believe, or if we should believe it. Americans need to know more, not less, about the world our elected and other government officials live in. They need sufficient information to debate policy and decide on who is to lead them. They need facts, analysis, and exposés to help drive the debate, expose corruption, and crowd officials. Do we believe that journalists should be the public surrogates in Washington and elsewhere? Do we still believe that? That journalists should be the surrogates asking the questions other concerned citizens would ask if they had a chance? And do we understand, we journalists, that many of us, too many of us, seem to have lost touch with the people? And that this is true of those who cover City Hall, the county government, and state capital, as well as those who cover Washington? Do we believe that too many of us in American journalism have become, at best, hesitant and reluctant, and at worst, frankly, fearful and intimidated? Do we believe that too many of us now seek to shock readers, listeners, and viewers, and or to feed off their most base instincts? Do we understand that when we turn our investigative tools toward this end, we breed cynicism in our audience and make ourselves easy targets for those who seek to discredit the work we do to uncover truly important information? Do we understand, and we keep it in the front of our minds, that a war rages daily in American journalism between sensationalism and seriousness, and that sensationalism is winning? That sensation and shouting are prized now over explanation and investigation. Have we lost our heart for the fight, the ongoing fight for quality journalism? Do we understand that every inch we yield on this battlefield makes the serious ground doubly hard to regain? Because serious reporting can only be appreciated by an audience that has been educated to hold and to value serious concerns.
Former CBS News anchor Dan Rather speaking at the annual Investigative Reporters and Editors Convention in Denver. To hear the entire speech, visit our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.